Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the MoCo Beat. I am Dana Tofig.
And I'm Tom Moore.
We are so glad that you're joining us. We have a very exciting show. Last time, we had our first in-person guest, and today we have our first virtual guest.
Through the magic of Skype, the executive director of Common Cause Maryland, Jennifer Bevan-Dangle, joins us and talks to us all about what's going on in Montgomery County with good government and public financing and what you need to know to be a good citizen in Maryland.
And then I will give us an update on the bus depot situation that has to do with putting buses at Carver and just what's the next steps when it comes to finding a bus depot for Montgomery County.
After a big, big win for Rockville citizens this week.
Absolutely. This was definitely a win for them. So let's get started on episode 3 of the MoCo Beat.
We're here with Jennifer Bevan-Dangle, the executive director of Common Cause Maryland. Hey, Jennifer.
Good evening. How are you?
We're glad that you're here with us today. I guess we're going to talk a little bit about Common Cause and what they're doing and what they're focusing on now. And we'll be talking a little bit about Montgomery County and its public campaign finance law.
Fantastic.
Yeah, we hear you're an expert on it.
I know a thing or two.
And I have some pretty firsthand knowledge on this, which I have a little disclaimer up front. I am on the Common Cause Maryland board. Jennifer and I have known each other for a couple of years. She does great work for the organization in Annapolis, but I am hardly disinterested in her work.
But my disclaimer is that I've never met you except on Skype now. So
you can be the neutral party.
You got it.
So Jennifer, tell us about Common Cause. What is Common Cause Maryland doing in the state?
Fantastic. Common Cause Maryland is very unique. We're the only organization in the state that is focused solely on how well our government is working and how responsive it is to its citizens. So whether that's the state legislature in Annapolis, whether that's the county councils or sometimes our municipalities, we watch voting issues, money and politics issues, transparency, ethics, redistricting, all of the core pillars of democracy itself. And the reforms we advance are all aimed at making sure that citizens' voices are the loudest voice in our democracy and that they're not being drowned out or excluded or shut out of public meetings.
How long has Common Cause been around and how big is the organization in Maryland?
So Common Cause was formed in 1970 when John Gardner put his open letter in the paper calling for a citizens' army to hold elected officials accountable. The state chapter was formed in 1974, and we've been a constant presence ever since. We've always been on the smaller side, and so it's very exciting that we have been growing extraordinarily quickly in the last few years. We now have 3 full-time, 1 part-time staffer, as well as a team of fantastic interns and a growing board. So we're really turning a corner as an organization. I think it reflects the time we live in, that there is simply so much work to do on democracy, and democracy issues have never been so prominent.
So Common Cause is a national organization and a state organization. What can you tell us about the difference between the two?
It's really just our level of focus. We're not independently incorporated, so we can't take a position in contrary to the national organization. We couldn't decide to prohibit anyone under the age of 30 from voting. National would have a thing or two to say about that. But the national organization focuses on the congressional level, national politics, FEC, whereas here in Maryland, we really do focus on the state house and the county councils.
You know, you mentioned transparency, and I think it's something I worked for Montgomery County Public Schools for a long time. And I handled Freedom of Information Act requests. I handled a lot of that. In some ways, it's like the most transparent time in American history. There are no secrets. And yet, there's also, it feels like, the least transparent time. Can you talk a little bit about that? There seems like it's pulling in two ways.
I think the expectations for what people will have access to is constantly growing. With the internet, with Google search, with Facebook, there is this increasing feeling that people should know the minutiae. They should immediately know the decisions that are being made, the documents that their elected officials see. So while we have some good bones in place as far as our Public Information Act, open meetings law, the structures aren't always able to meet that demand. It's also created a slight hesitation at times from the public officials because information travels so quickly, because of the mob mentality you sometimes run into on social media especially. There seems to be a reluctance at times to be quite as transparent because what might be in the scheme of things a smaller slip up can be turned into something very significant through the social media machine. So I think that hesitation has created a bit of a backlash, which is in direct contrast to the expectation that people have that they should know what's going on.
So what can you tell people about how Common Cause actually does its work? Your office is in Annapolis for a good reason. What is it you guys do day to day, and how does it change throughout the year?
Our work is very driven by the legislative session. A lot of people don't realize that Maryland does not have the initiative process. So some of the great reforms we've seen other states take, like California's redistricting reform, that was brought by the people to the ballot and moved forward that way. Maryland, everything has to be led by the legislators. So we spend a lot of time during session, almost 24/7, fighting for the best bills that we can, whether that's campaign finance reforms or voting expansion, redistricting that was led by the governor this year, you know, all the different issues that are out there. So once the session ends, we shift gears significantly. We start to look at local opportunities for reform, the Montgomery County legislation. We have a ballot initiative in Howard. We also spend more time researching the issues, researching emerging policies, and responding to reporter calls. A lot of the issues that get flagged for us come up because a reporter will call and say, this elected official engaged in behavior, do you think that was acceptable? And that sometimes triggers an idea for us that, well, we need a law that can fix the situation. We also work on the elections. We were not able to shift gears from session in time to have the impact we had hoped for the primary, but we're certainly hoping to grow a team working in coalition to get election protection monitors at the polls in November to make sure that there aren't the same concerns that people experienced in April.
What were some of those concerns in April?
Well, we did see Baltimore City's election decertified, and they had to audit and do a recount, which to us was a testament that the paper trail machines, the state has been on a long journey to transition our machines to these paper trail systems, and they worked because they were able to be audited. But some of the problems we've heard, it was a mix of people not being able to vote or register to vote during early voting the way that they should have been, former felons getting bad information, still being turned away and not able to register and vote, and then also some of the problems with poll workers, especially again in Baltimore, but we did hear some concerns in Montgomery, not knowing how to use the machines and not being quite ready for election day. So there was quite a lot that had to get rolled out, and hopefully we'll be more prepared for it in November.
All right. Now, one of the topics that Common Cause has been real involved with in Montgomery County is our public financing. And this came into effect a year or two ago now. But hasn't actually been used in an election. What can you tell us about this system, and what does it mean for county elections?
Montgomery County is leading the way, and it's tremendously exciting. Public funding is a system where a candidate for office decides to rely and only fundraise from everyday small dollar donations from real people. It's a radically different way of fundraising than the way our campaigns are traditionally run. And in return, that candidate gets matched with a public match so that they're still competitive. Because sadly, in our day and age, you do need a certain amount of money to get your message out and to be heard. Montgomery County had been interested in these programs for quite some time. They've been proven to work from Arizona to Maine to Connecticut. They've been proven to expand diversity in our elected officials. When Connecticut initiated their program, Latino representation went up, women representation went up. The diversity of the legislature improved dramatically. And they're proven to help legislators focus on the people who sent them there, their constituents. So Montgomery County has been looking at these programs for quite some time, really wanted to do something, but was prohibited by state law. So in 2013, we helped pass, as part of a package of reforms, enabling language, where the state said, okay, Montgomery, you know, all the counties, if you want to try these programs, here's your chance. Feel free. And then create a program and see how it works. So Montgomery County, the council members led by Phil Andrews, jumped on it right away. 2014, we had a bill. It passed unanimously. And it's a very strong bill. It's one of the first programs to be established since some of the bad Supreme Court cases came down. So the program accounts for some of the change in the political fundraising landscape. So it's a very strong program. And they've been funding it aggressively. So we think it'll be ready by 2018 for its inaugural election. And it's our hope now that the council members running for re-election or new candidates aggressively try to use the program.
All right. Well, I got to do a little disclosure on this one as well. I was involved a little bit in the lobbying to get it passed. There were some amendments that were attempted along the way that that I didn't like, that Common Cause didn't like, and we managed to beat those back. So what, in action, what does this program look like? You know, what, who can you take money from? How much money can you take? And what do the matches look like?
So say I lived in Montgomery County and I wanted to run for office. If I have an existing campaign account, I would have to lock it down, put it on ice. So any candidate who's already been raising money from a variety of sources has to freeze all of that and start over effectively. You can start raising small donations, $150 or less, from individuals. So no corporate gifts, no PAC gifts, no political committee gifts. Real people have to fund your campaign. And you have to qualify. So you have to hit certain thresholds to show that you're a viable candidate and that people really do like you to before the county will spend any taxpayer dollars on your campaign. And the thresholds are different. We have an executive threshold, the at-large, and then the districts. For county executive, it's 500 contributions from individuals, so a fairly high number, totaling 40,000. Which, since it's $150 increments or less, is very aggressive. We're not going to be spending money on people who have no hope of winning or have no real support. For at-large council members, 250 different contributions totaling 20,000. And for district council members, 125 contributions totaling 10,000. So it scales down depending how big your race is, but still a very aggressive threshold. So candidates who have not had a fundraising entity should start thinking now about, you know, how they're going to go about getting these small dollar contributions.
Is the program mandatory?
No. The Supreme Court has been clear that public funding programs are constitutional. They've never struck them down, but they have to be voluntary and they can't contain certain provisions that would unfairly favor a publicly funded candidate, like trigger provisions that would candidate a slug of money if they were being radically outspent by their opponent. So there are certain limitations the court has put around these programs, even though they are, again, proven constitutional.
You know, as someone who isn't familiar with the campaign finance laws, I will say it's heartening to hear, because I think one of the things that people feel is the reason that even on a federal level that action doesn't get taken that should be taken. I mean, you know, people have been seeing the last few days about action. Is there going to be any action about guns, right? Is there going to do anything to control the access to guns? The NRA is so powerful that public finance is an answer to the kind of influence. Now, we're not seeing it on the federal level, but at the local level, it's a way of keeping big money, at least controlling big money in elections.
The reports that were done on Connecticut showed that legislation that was very popular, polled very well with everyday people, but had been just stonewalled in their state legislature for year after year. When they had their first batch of publicly funded elected officials, almost all those bills sailed through. So it is interesting to see that in practice, it really did change the voting habits of the legislative body there. And Congressman Sarbanes, who has the federal bill, to create public funding systems for congressional candidates, you know, he talks about the burden and the fundraising burden and how that just skews everything. The time spent making donor phone calls that's not being spent on policy, the pressure to then please your donors so you can go back to them and ask for more money later, it really starts to change your decision-making process. And it's not a corrupt, people are buying your vote, but it is a relationship that changes, and it's a decision-making process that changes that public funding can free people from.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's not just the, you know, it's not just, we're not just talking about the NRA, right? It's anything. I mean, if you want to cut the budget, you need to start talking about entitlements. You need to start talking about defense spendings. And there are powerful lobbies out there trying to protect those areas, you know, all with you know, mostly with good intention, but still, you know, that influence is there. There's no doubt about it. And it's part of the reason that those are kind of third rails when you're talking about cutting the budget.
And we know that the money spent in congressional races is astronomical, but people are often surprised to hear how much is spent even at the county level. Your average county executive race for nearly any county executive position in the state is now over $1 million. And in Montgomery County, the average council race is $200,000. Some of them cost $300,000. So it's a lot of money that these candidates need to raise, even at the local level.
Absolutely.
So how does this compare to what Montgomery County has had in place? You probably know this better than I, even though I ran a race under these rules, but I think it was a $1,000 maximum contribution, and you can take them from anywhere, including businesses. Does that sound about right?
So the current campaign finance law, the individual gift limit is actually $6,000. So businesses, lobbyists, corporations, PACs, political committees, there's a lot of I'll give you some money if you give me some money that happens with our elected officials. They can all donate money up to that $6,000 limit. Thanks to the Supreme Court, we have no other caps. We used to have an aggregate giving limit. So you could only give, it was $10,000 and it was going to go up to $24,000, but you could only give in any 4-year cycle $10,000 and then you were done, because of our aggregate cap. So you might give a little bit here and there, a couple council members, a couple legislators, and you would be done. Thanks to the Supreme Court, in a case called McCutcheon, we now have no aggregate cap in Maryland. So we've seen a lot of changes in our campaign landscape. And I think that the cost to run is only going to go up, continue to go up because of this.
Does the public finance make it possible to still run a campaign? I mean, if somebody said, no, I'm not going to take the public financing, would it be easier for them to raise more money?
It would. There is no denying that raising a handful of large checks from a handful of able givers is easier than doing the hard work of getting small dollar citizen donations. And I'm sure some of our candidates some of our current council members who have been used to fundraising the old way, you know, there's got to be a lot of trepidation out there about how do I change gears so drastically? But I think Raskin's campaign showed in a very expensive primary, and this is congressional, but it was one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive, congressional primaries in the nation for that district race. And he was not the biggest spender, and he was still able to win. So our message with public funding is you don't necessarily have to spend more money, but you do have to have enough money to have your message heard. Governor Hogan is a testament to that. He used the state's existing public funding system, which we only currently have a program statewide for governor. He was drastically outspent by Anthony Brown, and he was still able to win. So we do believe that public funding might never easily give you the most money, but it'll certainly give you enough to have your message heard. And then it just comes down to who the better candidate is.
And Jennifer, when I was running for office, I spent a depressing amount of time locked in a room with my campaign manager watching me while I dialed for dollars. And there was a lot of, you know, you go after the richest targets. And so I don't think I had the nerve to ask anybody for $6,000. But, you know, you ask the just because time is your most precious asset, you try to ask the fewest people for the largest amount of money that you possibly can. When a candidate spends their time doing that versus raising a maximum of $150 from individual voters, how does that actually change? Does that change politicians? Does it change office holders? Is there a good just in that?
We certainly see, and this is not to cast aspersions on any current council members, but by and large, when you're fundraising from that suite of donors, even if they're in line with the values of your constituents writ large, they still drive your decision-making in a certain direction. The wealthier donors are going to have different interests often than the rest of the community that isn't represented in that way. The other problem is people aren't stupid, and they see this money race that too often determines who will even appear on the primary, if not who will win and appear on the general ballot. So everyday constituents, the constituents only have $20, $50 to donate, they feel cut out of the system before primary day even rolls around. And we do believe it's one of the reasons why turnout is depressed, because people feel like the game's already been rigged before they come out to vote. So one great feature with the Montgomery County program is it incentivizes smaller donations. This is one of those modern tweaks that I talked about that really make the Montgomery program a national leader. The first $50 contribution is worth more than the second 50, and that's worth more than the third 50. So a candidate could go to a more economically depressed neighborhood, maybe an immigrant community, maybe a community that isn't traditionally heard very loudly in our political system, and they can collect $20, $50 from 20, 30 people in that room, and it'll have the same value to them once it's matched as a major donor dinner with 10 wealthier people would have had. So it completely inverts whose voice gets heard and opens that door to entire constituencies that currently are just not participating.
All right, so let's talk some real numbers. I'm having a neighborhood meeting and I'm running for an at-large seat on the county council, say. And I walk in the room and, someone gives me $10. How is that matched, and what does that mean to me, assuming I've qualified for the program?
So for the county council, the first $50 is matched 4-1, the second is matched 3-1, and the third 50 is matched 2-1. So if you collect $50 from 10 people and then you get it matched, you're looking... I might have to open a calendar here. You never ask the lobbyist for math. That's a cruel thing to do. But you're only walking away with $50 in direct contributions, but that gets matched to $500. So suddenly that room of smaller donors has a very big impact on your potential success or failure as a candidate.
So if someone hands me a $10 contribution, it's really worth, if it's matched 4-1, that's actually worth $50.
It's worth 50, that's correct.
All right.
And that goes down as you get more from that donor. So if that donor gives you another $50 down the road, it's not matched quite the same.
That's correct. And it is aggregate over a 4-year election window. So it does force you to go to a much broader net of people.
And it would still be, if that person would just give you the $150 up front, it would still be, then it would be worth something like $750. But I mean, you're still talking, I think what you're saying is the small donor has more power right up front. So people who are going to just be able to give you a $10 donation one time, at $10 is $50. And that's powerful in an election. That's real money.
And it's certainly our hope that, again, communities that aren't part of your traditional donor network and that tend to be therefore less represented in turnout because they're not being talked to from the start of the process all the way through to the end. Those communities can now rally around candidates that represent them in a very deep and meaningful way, and that those communities can even help fund that person and project them into office, which is one of the reasons the programs have proven to help increase diversity very significantly, because the major donor networks in politics are very hard to crack into.
So the first test of this program is going to be 2018, when the county executive is up and the entire county council is up. What has to happen between now and then for this program to be a success?
The program still needs another $2 million, which will ensure that it can fund all the candidates that we anticipate could potentially, you know, seek to run and be qualified. And it's very important that all the qualified candidates get the funding they deserve, that they earn, because otherwise it will put a big cloud over the program that it made false promises. And we think that when we're trying to fix our democracy, false promises are maybe the worst thing that could happen to us. So certainly we need that last $2 million. And then the candidates need to make their choice. We're going to see the existing county council members start to hold fundraisers even this fall. It's not that far away from 2018. And like I said, if they want to participate in a public funded program, they need to close down, put on ice any existing campaign accounts that they might have and start fresh. They need to start a new account to show that it's clean. So those candidates, all the incumbents, have to make a choice very soon. Challengers tend to jump in later. So we think that we'll start to see challengers coming in, creating these accounts, you know, probably maybe some in the fall, but definitely more next year. But one thing that constituents can do now is call your county councilman member, call the county executive challengers that you know might be thinking of running, and ask them, what do you intend to do? Because once they start fundraising the old way, it'll be very hard for them to decide to change gears and open a public funded account. So they need to decide now from the start what they intend to do.
What is Common Cause going to do between now and the election to make this program a success?
We're working with some volunteers in the county to create an outreach plan. It's hard because your normal outreach, you wait until after the filing deadline, you know who all your candidates are, and then you send them your questionnaire or your pledge or whatever it might be. Here we're playing a little bit of a game of pin the tail on the donkey where you don't necessarily know who's going to run. We don't know what's going to happen with the county executive seat and what that might mean. So our plan is to certainly reach out to the incumbents and then to do a bit of a speaker's tour, go to different community groups, Democratic clubs, Republican clubs, talk about the program, make sure people are informed, and just promote it everywhere as much as we can so that any candidate who's thinking of running has this on their radar. Things like this are a perfect example.
Well, what else is Common Cause going to be focusing on in the coming months, in the coming years? I know, obviously, we're entering a very busy time. You had mentioned the county council will be run. Some of the county council members will be running. County executive has indicated he is not going to run again, Ike Leggett. So we're going to have a new county executive. My guess is some people on the county council will be seeking that. What are the big issues you'll be working on for the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, thanks to the leadership from Montgomery County, we had interest in Howard County in creating a similar program. But their council structure, their funding authority is very different than Montgomery County. So to create a program and be able to fund it over 4 years, we actually sent the program to the ballot. So we have a ballot question on the Howard County ballot this November, which is very exciting, but also, you know, always a little bit scary. No one wants to go up there and not win very resoundingly. So we'll be working incredibly hard in the immediate term to make sure that that ballot is successful, that people are excited about the program, and that we can get a strong program up and running in Howard County. As we look at the legislative session, we have a lot of unfinished business on voter reforms, access to voting, voter modernization. There's a dialogue that started nationally around automatic voter registration. This issue came up last session. It was the first year the legislature had discussed it. And we're hoping to bring that conversation back. California, Oregon, Illinois, West Virginia, they've all passed these programs. And what they do is it flips the burden instead of having barriers to your citizens to say, well, if you want to vote, you have to go do all these hoops and make sure that you're registered. It puts the burden on the government to say, we'll capture your names and register you so that you're ready to go on election day. So it's a great way to make sure that no one's left behind, no one's not caught up in our system, and everyone's able to vote. Because we think there might be more of a learning curve, more work to do to pass this in Maryland, we're also starting to talk about same-day voter registration. A lot of people, about 1,900 people, were able to vote because they came in during early voting and they registered and they voted. And that was a tremendous success. This especially helps young students who, you know, maybe changed their address, people who are more transient. And the difference is you could do that during early voting, but you still can't register to vote on election day and cast your ballot. And election day is when everybody goes, oh no, this is the day, it's happening, I need to go vote. So we would still like to see that next step reached where we have same-day voter registration on election day. So those are our big voter modernization fights. We're also working with the Attorney General's office on a transparency study. We passed a very sweeping modernization to the Public Information Act 2 years ago. And now the Attorney General is looking at some of the more technical issues that we couldn't resolve during the pace of the legislative session. So we hope to have some good recommendations by December and another bill that will further strengthen the public's access to data, either in this session or the following year. And of course, redistricting reform, an issue very close to our hearts. We've been fighting on this for decades. The governor's been leading with a very strong proposal, and we hope that we can build broader support for reform and win something before the redistricting process starts again in 2022.
You know, I'm just going to give a plug for a friend of mine who has a book. I can't say the name of the book because it'll make us an obscene podcast, but it's called Rat Effed. And he wrote the book about how there's been a real change that when the Democrats took the presidency, there was a real change in philosophy. It was, from a political standpoint, brilliant that the GOP moved towards state legislators to change the way to get Republican majorities and change the way that redistricting is done. And that's how you keep majorities in the House and Senate. And it was it's an interesting book. I've read some of it. So if you are interested in that topic, I would suggest it by David Daley.
And we do have our annual, it's not a birthday celebration because we're not really that happy about it, but it's a birthday commemoration for Elbridge Gerry, who is the namesake of the gerrymander. I suppose it should be the gerrymander. So free cake and ice cream on Lawyers Mall in Annapolis on July 14th, 10:30 to 12. It's always a fun event, although it's almost always torturously hot. But certainly everyone is willing to welcome to join us.
All right. Thank you. So those of us who live in Montgomery County, if someone wants to get involved with Common Cause, how can they find out more about it? What are things that, if you live in Montgomery County, you can do if you want to be involved in these issues?
There's a lot. We're trying to build this county team to help do outreach to candidates and incumbents. Anyone interested in getting some literature or maybe even speaking at a community group, even if you just know community groups or political clubs or civic clubs we should come to, let us know. We really want to do a speaker's tour and spread the word. The other thing we constantly need are people who are just active and involved and willing to take our action alerts and call their legislators, which Montgomery County members are often the best at being willing to pick up that phone and make their voice heard. And you can sign up for our action alerts at our website, which is MD for Maryland, md.commoncause.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, Common Cause Maryland, or at Common Cause MD. To be honest, we update our Facebook very regularly. We update our Twitter almost addictively. The website, therefore, gets a bit less love. So certainly go to our website to sign up for our action alerts. Make a donation. It is the end of our fiscal year. We're on a July to June calendar. So we would love any last fiscal gifts or launch our new year with a bang, but you can also sign up for the action alerts there. But if you want to know the day-to-day, what's happening, what we're talking about, certainly Facebook and Twitter are where to find us.
Well, thank you very much. This has really been informative. As somebody who's not, I mean, Tom Dre ensconced in a lot of these issues, I am not. This has been a fascinating discussion. So please, you know, if you're interested, go to md.commoncause.org to learn more and learn more about the local public financing law. And maybe it's something that can spread. Maybe Montgomery County can be an example for the nation on how it's done.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Jennifer, thanks so much for your time.
Have a great day.
All right, so we had some movement this week on the Carver school site and the bus depot. Dana, what can you tell us about it?
Right, well, for those who aren't aware, the county has been planning to develop around the Shady Grove Metro Station, and they have moved some things out. One of the things that would have to move for that development to continue is the bus depot for the Montgomery County Public Schools. It has 410 buses on it. A bus depot is a major part of the smooth operation of a bus system. So, you know, scattering buses all over at 20 different sites, that doesn't work. So there have been a lot of places that have been proposed.
Dana, why do you know so much about this issue?
Right. So full disclosure, as we always do, I used to work for Montgomery County Public Schools for 6 years. I was the public information officer. And this issue of the bus depot was talked about a lot during my time there. So I'm very familiar with it. I certainly have opinions as a neighbor of the Carver lot, which was, so basically, if you're not familiar with the issue, there was going to be a temporary solution, which was, and as part of the temporary solution to move the buses out of the Shady Grove Depot, 100 or so buses were going to come to the front lot at the Carver Educational Services Center, which is right at the corner of 355 and Manicky Street, right there at Hungerford and Manicky, and they were going to put about 100 buses there. There was a lot of opposition to it. I live less than a mile from there, so I wasn't all that jazzed about having the buses there either. There was a great public turnout. I think that one of the things you can say about this is the public got involved. They got engaged really fast. I think that's great. There was also a plan to put 100 buses down at, I think it's the Westmore site.
In Lincoln Park.
In Lincoln Park. There was a lot of opposition to that. There was a plan at one time to do the full depot over on Avery Road near Redgate Golf Course. There was a lot of opposition to that. So basically what the news is this. County executive has said, for the moment, they're not going to move the depot out. They've asked the county council, you know, not to take a vote to basically say to developers, you can now have this land. It's going to remain a bus depot until they find a permanent site for the buses, all of them. I don't think they want to do a temporary fix. They really want to do the full fix.
Now, the county's risking a little bit of liability here. Wasn't there some talk about if they didn't find a new spot for these buses now that they'd be sued by the developer?
They might be, and I really don't know what's going to go on behind the scenes there. My guess is if they did move it to some of these other places, they'd probably be sued by residents. So, I mean, I think it's one of those things that you have to deal with in government. You know, I think, you know, you and I have talked about this. This is kind of a victory for public outcry and organization, right? The public got together and they made their points and they made them well. And the county did what they should have done, which was back off of the plan, take a step back and say, all right, we can't just move forward without finding a place for 410 buses.
And it's worth saying what this was composed of. This was a lot of people showing up at hearings. This was yard signs. This was people being very active on social media. And there was one hell of a public meeting that was held where I think it was people were coming out of the rafters, maybe 400 people at this meeting.
Yeah, something, several hundred people at the meeting. I mean, having been at MCPS for long, that actually happens more than you'd think. But people felt very strongly about it. And that's what should happen. The public should turn out, and they should let their opinions be known. Here's what I hope happens now. We've got these kind of coalitions of people working together, right? They prevented something from happening, at least temporarily. So what next? I hope there's the same enthusiasm for helping the county and MCPS find a solution as there was for saying not here.
The buses can't stay where they are. Yeah, and it's probably not a good idea for Montgomery County for these buses to be where they are, because it's to have 410 buses within walking distance of a major metro station is a waste of that opportunity.
Right. And they're building homes there, they're building business. I mean, it they want to move forward with this. And the plan itself is a good plan, right? I mean, they want to develop around Metro, and that's a good thing. But they, so they need to find a place for them. So I just hope that there is some enthusiasm for trying to identify areas that could happen. I thought the Avery Road site was a good site. You know, I know there was some neighborhood pushback, but
what are the complications there?
There's the road there is it's Avery Road. It's not a huge road. So, I mean, it would be crowded when the buses are coming in and out. Definitely. I think that's true anywhere you go. And there would have to be some changes to the land, to the way that it's laid out to make it, the buses happen. And there are, my understanding, there's a small number of homes that are near it, but not as close, for instance, as they were to the Carver lot.
And on the Avery Road site, there's an educational program there already.
Right. So the one of the big stumbling blocks is the alternative programs. You know, kids who haven't succeeded in traditional school environments, they can go to an alternative program. Mm-hmm. The alternative programs are located there. So you'd have to find a place for that. I don't think that would be as hard. There are going to be buildings that can be used, can be renovated, that would give alternative programs, you know, a great opportunity and a great school. But, you know, again, these are not easy decisions. I think there are solutions out there, and I think that a lot of the people who have been kind of active in saying not here can say, all right, well, I've talked to some people, and how about here, or how about here? Or when there is a plot of land that the county has to buy in order for a depot, that there'll be some level of support for that to say, you know what, this is a good thing, it's the right place, so we want to come out and support you instead of yelling. I think, you know, if I had a frustration in dealing with school issues sometimes, there's a lot of energy behind not here and not as much energy around here.
And in some ways, there's good reason for those who are big on, you know, not here to actually put some energy into saying put it here instead, because the message from the county executive this week was not here now.
Absolutely, right. I mean, like all the sites that they've been thinking of, that could still happen. So I don't think the idea was that there'll never be buses parked at Carver. There won't be buses parked at Carver for now, but a long-term solution has to be developed. The sooner that happens, the less likely it is that a temporary solution will be needed.
All right. But it's funny. I think we both know that it's a lot harder to harness people's energies and passions when you're looking for some good solution out there somewhere, rather than, you know, blocking a very specific thing that's going to happen in my backyard.
Right. I don't want to be critical of people who are concerned about what's happening in their backyard, because if somebody's building a school next to your house, you know what that means. I mean, it certainly changes the area. I get that. But it's for the greater good. I think there has to be kind of a big picture, but you never blame people for standing up for what they think. And yeah, I mean, putting 100 buses to Carver was going to affect some people a lot. Yeah. So, you know, the conversations I had with some of my neighbors were that, you know, I wasn't putting a sign in my yard and I didn't show up at the meeting to oppose it because I could see it from both sides, right? This is something that's been talked about for a long time. And when the county decided to go forward with that, you know, it was assumed that they were going to help us find, you know, a site for that depot. And that hasn't happened.
The developers would.
Yeah, the developers would, or the county would help MCPS find a site for that depot. Certainly MCPS would be a part of that. And that just hasn't. Every place that MCPS has thought of, it's always been not here. So I wasn't an active part of not here, but I was not thrilled about having 100 buses parked up the street from me, and they would be coming right down in front of my house in the morning. So I'm glad it didn't happen. I think it is a victory for people who, you know, stood up and were very focused on their message. So now the question is, what's next? And I hope as many people are involved in coming up with a solution.
Yeah, I think the folks, everybody who's involved with the Carver Coalition really deserves a big round of applause this week. They got their job done, but now they have an opportunity to actually solve the problem rather than just forestall it.
Absolutely, and I certainly hope that happens. I'd like to see it.
Dana, thank you for that update. That's one of some of the biggest news in Montgomery County this week.
Absolutely, and this has been a great podcast. I think we've done a good job. I wanted to ask you about one thing. You posted something on Facebook about Chewies. Tell us about that. So
Chewies is an absolutely classic, I believe it's out of Austin, Texas, restaurant, Tex-Mex restaurant. They have crazy interiors. It's spelled C-H-U-Y apostrophe S. You can Google it. Crazy interiors and terrific food, just unbelievably good food. And they've been expanding outside of Texas recently. They have a couple restaurants in the D.C. area. I've been trying to get over to Virginia, which I think is the closest one right now. And they've just announced that they're going to be opening up just outside the city of Rockville near the Silver Diner where the Ruby Tuesdays just closed. Mm-hmm. So they've just inked that deal. It's going to be probably a good amount of time before they can find all the, you know, ostrich feathers and license plates to put on the walls. that is going to be quite a thing. And you will get full coverage from the MoCo beat when that restaurant opens.
We will be all over it. Like, again, for you, not for us.
For you, our listeners. All right. I think that's all we got for this episode. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you, Tom. And thank you for listening to the MoCo beat. We will see you next time.